It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Is Western civilization in decline?
The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive.
President Trump gave a controversial speech in Poland back in July 2017 in which he claimed that Western civilization faces a profound existential threat. For conservatives in America, it was a triumph.
It's rare for a president to, in these postmodern times, or any European leader, any Western leader, to make an unapologetic defense of Western culture and civilization, so I was surprised.
That's Victor Davis Hanson. He's a classics scholar and contributor to the National Review, and he's been warning for years that the most important problem in the world today is the decline of Western civilization. So in Poland, the president agreed and asked what we're going to do about it.
Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost?
Most people say Western civilization is unique or it's exceptional, but we've done this and we've done that. But there was no apologies there. It was sort of, we can be good without being perfect.
So our question this hour, does Western civilization need saving? And if so, from what and who?
Do we have the desire and the courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it?
Steve Paulson sat down with Victor Davis Hanson to talk about President Trump's Poland speech.
He uses the word West 10 Yes. times in that speech, and another 5 times he talks about our civilization.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering what or who is the West,
and what
civilization is he referring to?
Well, originally, you know, the West was a very ethnocentric term that the Greeks used, and it was called the Occident, where the word means setting sun, and the Orient was the when they looked across the Aegean, that's where the sun rose. But always the West has been redefined and recalibrated, and very soon the Romans took over Greece, and then they said they were the West as well. And then during the European expansion, they said they were the West. And then the New World, especially North America, said they were the West. And now if you talk to people from South Korea to Taiwan to Australia to Japan, they say they're the West. And that's not true of any other culture, which usually is defined by racial or ethnic tribalism. And yet the West is a concept that anybody can be a Westerner if you accept the precepts of the West, and we know what they are. They're roughly 8 or 10 agreed-on assumptions of free market economics, protection of private property, free speech, free expression, secularism, diversity of religion, emancipation of women, trust in rationalism and scientific inquiry and induction rather than deductive or religious superstition.
So this is not a matter of geography. I mean, you're saying that Australia or Japan would fit into this definition.
It's not only not a matter of geography, it's not a matter of ethnic, gender, racial characteristics. It's started in Athens, and it's way, way beyond the, in terms of time and space, the small confines and parochial confines of its birth.
You know, it's so interesting hearing you say this because, I mean, there are a lot of critics of Trump's speech. I mean, they interpreted this as code for supporting white nationalism. That's not what you're saying.
No, I think that's an ignorance of history. And it's also sort of patronizing. I don't think that as someone who was of Swedish background that Abraham Lincoln belongs to me or Socrates belongs to me because he might look more like me than somebody from Jamaica. By the same token, I think if Bob Marley comes to the United States and plays music, I have just as much right to enjoy him as somebody from Jamaica. This idea of cultural appropriation, I think, has been blasphemous.
You do not think that Trump was referring to countries specifically with predominantly white and Christian populations?
No, I don't. I think that if you ask him, is South Korea and Japan a strong Western ally, he would say yes, and essential to the security of the United States. I really do. And I think if you ask him, if you go down to South America, are there certain South American countries, Chile maybe, and increasingly Colombia, maybe even Argentina, that are starting to reform again and join the Western family? I think he would say yes. That's not to be naive. All people are tribal, and Western civilization started in Europe. But whereas Islam had some degree of success transcending the Middle East. There was no religion or no, like Christianity or no culture, like classical culture, that was able to constantly reinvent itself and to be embraced and adopted, modified, rejected, improved by people who did not look anything like the original creators in Southern Europe.
Do you see Western identity as being fundamentally Judeo-Christian?
If fundamentally is an exclusionary term, the answer is no, because then, of course, it becomes theocratic. If you mean fundamentally in the religious sphere, I'd say yes, but it's in tandem with a very strong, always was, secular idea that under the U.S. Constitution and most Western countries, there's a protection of freedom to worship. And so we've always had a majority Christian population. And although we've had setbacks, we do protect the right to worship any god or no god at all, if you wish, under a Western aegis. That comes from Roman and Greek life as well.
So where does this leave Muslims in this whole scheme of the West and the values that you have been laying out as being particularly
Western? Well,
I
think people realize that we have a large number of people, not just Muslims, but Buddhist and atheist and others who come into Western countries, and they are not only given a level of religious protection, but they're given a level of religious protection they're not even allowed in their own country for Muslims. So what I'm getting at is that I'm sitting in a studio in Fresno, and there's two mosques in Fresno. I can guarantee you that a Muslim in those mosques has a much freer ability to critique Islam than he would in Saudi Arabia, and not to mention other religions. But we have to remember, we're humans, we're not gods. I've tried to go into, I have gone to, I think, to every Arab country now, and each time I've gone into at least the more pious, they've asked me, do you have a Bible, do you have a crucifix? And the idea that you could build a church in Saudi Arabia or Iran is just ludicrous. They wouldn't allow you to do it.
One thing that you've written that I was really struck by, you've said, sometimes a culture disappears with a whimper, not a bang. What do you mean by that?
Civilization's like a chain, and it's only as strong as each link. And so if you have a link, a generation of 20 or 30 years, and if that generation has not been taught the fundamentals of American history and tradition, then there's no reason why those traditions would continue. So if you take a poll, as recently was reported on campus, where 35 to 40% said they didn't believe in freedom of speech, or you ask students, as I have for 30 years in the classroom, what was Iwo Jima or what was Gettysburg, and they have no clue whatsoever, then we're starting to lose not only our shared historical experiences that replenish us and remind us who we are, but more importantly, we don't know the fundamentals of the Constitution. A very high-ranking official yesterday or day before yesterday gave a speech in which head of the Democratic National Committee, in which he said the Electoral College is not a constitutional item. It's not in the Constitution. And so we're having a lot of people, not just so-called poor people or so-called undereducated, but people who leave universities with supposedly top-notch brands of bachelors and masters and PhDs that have not been broadly educated in their own culture.
So what happens if we lose that sense of shared history? What becomes?
Then I think it's all up for grabs, and you can see it today. I think that if a municipality does not want a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was the founder of the Ku Klux Klan and I think committed atrocities at Fort Pillow, and they vote by a plebiscite in the community or by majority vote of an elected representative, then they should remove that statue. But Nathan Bedford Forrest is not James Longstreet, who was a reluctant Confederate general, then after the war was very instrumental in protecting blacks in the South, was a big advocate of Reconstruction. He worked for the federal government. So not all Confederate statues are the same, but you have to have some people in the community that can make that distinction and make that argument rather than just bowing to popular frenzy. But we're not getting people with voices that are informed, that warn people where this trajectory is going. We know where it goes. It goes to chaos. It goes to eventual correction through totalitarian remedies, and we don't want to do that.
Do you think that's a danger in the United States?
Yeah, I do.
We could become a totalitarian nation?
Yeah, I think when that happens, whether left or right, it never happens. That was what Orwell's career was dedicated to. It never happens that we're here to make you slaves. We're here to make you more egalitarian or more enlightened or more obedient or to improve your material lot. So I think it's very important that people on the left and right protect the First Amendment, that you should have absolute right of free speech and free expression. And there's a lot of things that I don't like as a traditional agrarian. I don't like a lot of stuff, but I don't think it's my right to go onto a campus and say this particular left-wing speech can't say something on campus.
Given the alarm that you have about sort of this collapse of Western culture, what should be done?
We have embraced the salad bowl and the sense that the United States is so flawed that it has to develop in a very different way than the Constitution envisioned it. And the result is that we're losing a lot of the things that made us successful in the past. And if we could inculcate civic responsibility in the schools, teach the Constitution, teach the Bill of Rights, if we could teach American history, both good and bad, but, you know, fully American history. If you look at colleges and look at how many classes are in American history, it's just vanishing. Civil War, it doesn't seem to be there. And just for a while, take a breather from this class has studies, you know, we have environmental studies and leisure studies and peace studies and ethnic studies and black studies and women's studies. And they're not always empirical inductive classes. Their point is to get a person from point A in ideology to point B rather than give examples and let the student make the inductive decision. So I think we need to get a more empirical curriculum in our K through 12 in the university. We need to emphasize that we all have something in common as sons and daughters of the U.S. Constitution. We need to look at be empirical and say, you know, whether you like it or not, the United States is where people want to come. And why is it? Why did everybody risk their lives to come to the United States and people are not dying to go to Syria or they're not dying to go into China or they will never be fully accepted as Japanese citizens? So we're an exceptional Western country, and yet sometimes I feel that people take it for granted or they think it's on autopilot and it doesn't have to be replenished, that they're going to get up each morning and it's going to be prosperous, secure, and successful. I just don't think there's any historical evidence that civilizations work like that.
Victor Davis Hanson. He's a senior fellow in classics and military history at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and he's a regular contributor to the National Review. Steve Paulson talked with him.